did not steal the egg, Dunk said. He was in the yard all day, tilting or watching others tilt. Peek will find the egg in his saddlebags all the same. The wine was boiling. Plum drew on a leather glove and said, Try not to scream. Then he pulled a strip of silk out of the boiling wine and began to wash the cut. Dunk did not scream. He gnashed his teeth and bit his tongue and smashed his fist against his thigh hard enough to leave bruises, but he did not scream. Sir Maynard used the rest of his good tunic to make a bandage and tied it tight around his arm. How does that feel? He asked when he was done. Bloody awful. Dunk shivered. Where's Egg?
With the gods, I told you.
Dunk reached up and wrapped his good hand around Plum's neck. Speak plain. I am sick of hints and winks. Tell me where to find the boy, or I will snap your bloody neck, friend or no.
The sept? You would do well to go armed.
Sir Maynard smiled.
Is that plain enough for you, Dunk?
His first stop was Sir Uthor Underleaf's pavilion. When Dunk slipped inside, he found only the squire Will bent over a washtub scrubbing out his master's small clothes.
You again? Sir Uthor is at the feast. What do you want?
My sword and shield. Have you brought the ransom?
No. Then why would I let you take your arms?
I have need of them.
That's no good reason.
How about try to stop me and I'll kill you?
Will gaped.
They're over there.
Tyrion. Somewhere in the great stone maze of Winterfell, a wolf howled. The sound hung over the castle like a flag of mourning. Tyrion Lannister looked up from his books and shivered, though the library was snug and warm. Something about the howling of a wolf took a man right out of his here and now and left him in a dark forest of the mind, running naked before the pack. When the direwolf howled again, Tyrion shut the heavy leather-bound cover of the book he was reading, a 100-year-old discourse on the changing of the seasons by a long-dead maester. He covered a yawn with the back of his hand. His reading lamp was flickering, its all but gone as dawnlight leaked through the high windows. He had been at it all night. Well, that was nothing new. Tyrion Lannister was not much a one for sleeping. His legs were stiff and sore as he eased down off the bench. He massaged some life back into them and limped heavily to the table where the septon was snoring softly, his head pillowed on an open book in front of him. Tyrion glanced at the title. A Life of the Grand Maester Æthelmure, no wonder. "Sheel," he said softly. The young man jerked up, blinking, confused, the crystal of his order swinging wildly on its silver chain. "I'm off to break my fast. See that you return the books to the shelves, and be gentle with Valyrian scrolls. The parchment is very dry. Armadon's Engines of War is quite rare, and yours is the only complete copy I've ever seen." Shale gaped at him, still half asleep. Patiently, Tyrion repeated his instructions, then clapped the septon on the shoulder and left him to his tasks. Outside, Tyrion swallowed a lungful of cold morning air and began his laborious descent of the steep stone steps that corkscrewed around the exterior of the library tower. It was slow going. The steps were cut high and narrow, while his legs were short and twisted. The rising sun had not yet cleared the walls of Winterfell, but the men were already hard at it in the yard below. Sandor Clegane's rasping voice drifted up to him. "The boy's a long time dying. I wish he'd be quicker about it." Tyrion glanced down and saw the hounds standing with Yon Joffrey as squires swarmed around them. "At least he dies quietly," the prince replied. "It's the wolf that makes the noise. I could scarcely sleep last night." Clegane cast a long shadow over the hard-packed earth as his squire lowered the black helm over his head. "I could silence a creature, if it please you," he said through his open visor. The boy placed a long sword in his hand. He tested the weight of it, slicing at the cold morning air. Behind him, the yard rang to the clangor of steel on steel. The notion seemed to delight the prince. "Send a dog to kill a dog," he exclaimed. "Winterfell is so infested with wolves, the Starks would never miss one." Tyrion hopped off the last step onto the yard. "I beg to differ, nephew," he said. "The Starks can count past six, unlike some princes I might name." Joffrey had the grace at least to blush. "A voice from nowhere," Sandra said. He peered through his helm, looking this way and that. "Spirits of the air." The prince laughed, as he always laughed when his bodyguard did this mama's farce. Tyrion was used to it. "Down here." The tall man peered down at the ground and pretended to notice him. "The little Lord Tyrion," he said. "My pardon, sir, I did not see you standing there." "I'm in no mood for your insolence today." Tyrion turned to his nephew. "Joffrey, it is past time you called on Lord Eddard and his lady to offer them your comfort." Joffrey looked as petulant as only a boy prince can look. "What good will my comfort do them?" "None," Tyrion said. "Yet it is expected of you. Your absence has been noted." "The Stark boy is nothing to me," Joffrey said. "I cannot avoid the wailing of women." Tyrion Lannister reached up and slapped his nephew hard across the face. The boy's cheek began to redden. "One word," Tyrion said, "and I will hit you again." "I'm going to tell Mother," Joffrey exclaimed. Tyrion hit him again. Now both cheeks flamed. "You tell your mother," Tyrion told him, "but first you get yourself to Lord and Lady Stark, and you fall to your knees in front of them, and you tell them how very sorry you are, and that you're at their service if there is the slightest thing you can do for them or theirs in this desperate hour, and that all your prayers go with them. Do you understand? Do you?" The boy looked as though he was going to cry. Instead, he managed a weak nod. Then he turned and fled headlong from the yard, holding his cheek. Tyrion watched him run. A shadow fell across his face. He turned to find Clegane looming overhead like a cliff. His soot-dark armor seemed to blot out the sun. He had lowered the visor over his helm. It was fashioned in the likeness of a snarling black hound, fearsome to behold. But Tyrion had always thought it a great improvement over Clegane's hideously burned face. "The prince will remember that, little lord." The helm turned his laugh into a hollow rumble. "I pray he does," Tyrion Lannister replied. "If he forgets, be a good dog and remind him." He glanced around the courtyard. "Do you know where I might find my brother?" "Breaking fast with the queen." "Ah," Tyrion said. He gave Sandor Clegane a perfunctory nod and walked away as briskly as his stunted legs would carry him, whistling. He pitied the first knight to try the hound today. The man did have a temper. A cold, cheerless meal had been laid out in the morning room of the guest house. Jaime sat at table, and Cersei and the children talking in low, hushed voices. "Is Robert still abed?" Tyrion asked as he seated himself, uninvited, at the table. His sister peered at him with the same expression of faint distaste she had worn since the day he was born. "The king has not slept at all," she told him. "He is with Lord Eddard. He has taken their sorrow deeply to heart." "He has a large heart, our Robert," Jaime said with a lazy smile. There was very little that Jaime took seriously. Tyrion knew that about his brother and forgave it. During all the terrible long years of his childhood, only Jaime had ever shown him the smallest measure of affection or respect, and for that Tyrion was willing to forgive him most anything. A servant approached. "Bread," Tyrion told him, "and two of those little fish, and a mug of that good dark beer to wash them down. Oh, and some bacon. Burn it until it turns black." The man bowed and moved off. Tyrion looked back to his siblings. Twins, male and female. They looked very much the part this morning. Both had chosen a deep green that matched their eyes. Their blond curls were all a fashionable tumble, and gold ornaments shone at wrists and fingers and throats. Tyrion wondered what it would be like to have a twin, and decided that he would rather not know. Bad enough to face himself in a looking-glass every day. Another him was a thought too dreadful to contemplate. Prince Tommen stood up. "Do you have news of Bran, Uncle?" "I stopped by their sick room last night," Tyrion announced. "There was no change. The Maester thought that was a hopeful sign." "I don't want Brandon to die," Tommen said timorously. "He was a sweet boy. Not like his brother. But then Jaime and Tyrion were somewhat less than peas in a pod themselves." "Lord Eddard had a brother named Brandon as well," Jaime mused. "One of the hostages murdered by Targaryen. It seems to be an unlucky name." "Oh, not so unlucky as all that, surely," Tyrion said. The servant brought his plate. He ripped off a chunk of black bread. Cersei was studying him warily. "What do you mean?" Tyrion gave her a crooked smile. "Why, only that Tommen may get his wish. The Maester thinks the boy may yet live." He took a sip of beer. Marcella gave a happy gasp, and Tommen smiled nervously, but it was not the children Tyrion was watching. The glance that passed between Jaime and Cersei lasted no more than a second, but he did not miss it. Then his sister dropped her gaze to the table. "That is no mercy. These northern guards are cruel to let the child linger in such pain." "What were the Maester's words?" Jaime asked. The bacon crunched when he bit into it. Tyrion chewed thoughtfully for a moment and said, "He thinks that if the boy were going to die, he would have done so already. It has been 4 days with no change." "Will Bran get better, Uncle?" little Marcella asked. She had all of her mother's beauty, but none of her nature. "His back is broken, little one," Tyrion told her. "The fall shattered his legs as well. They keep him alive with onion and water, or he would starve to death. Perhaps, if he wakes, he will be able to eat real food, but he will never walk again." "If he wakes," Cersei repeated, is that likely?" "Well, the guards alone know," Tyrion told her. "The Maester only hopes." He chewed some more bread. "I would swear that wolf of his is keeping the boy alive. The creature's outside his window, day and night, howling. Every time they chase it away, it returns. Maester said they closed the window once to shut out the noise, and Bran seemed to weaken. When they opened it again, his heart beat stronger." The queen shuddered. "There is something unnatural about those animals," she said. "They are dangerous. I will not have any of them coming south with us." Jaime said, "You'll have a hard time stopping them, sister. They follow those girls everywhere." Tyrion started on his fish. "Are you leaving soon, then?" "Not near soon enough," Cersei said. Then she frowned. "Are we leaving?" she echoed. "What about you? Gods, don't tell me you're staying here." Tyrion shrugged. "Benjen Stark is returning to the Night's Watch with his brother's bastard. I've a mind to go with them and see this war we've all heard so much of." Jaime smiled. "I hope you're not thinking of taking the black on us, sweet brother." Tyrion laughed. "What, me? Celibate? The oars would go begging from dawn to Casterly Rock. No, I just want to stand on top of the wall and piss off the edge of the world." Cersei stood abruptly. "The children don't need to hear this filth. Tommen, Marcella, come." She strode briskly from the morning room, her train and her pups trailing behind her. Jaime Lannister regarded his brother thoughtfully with those cold green eyes. "Stark will never consent to leave Winterfell, with his son lingering in the shadow of death." "We will, if Robert commands it," Tyrion said. And Robert will command it. There's nothing Lord Eddard can do for the boy in any case." "He could end his torment," Jaime said. "I would, if it were my son. It would be a mercy." "I advise against putting that suggestion to Lord Eddard, sweet brother," Tyrion said. "He would not take it kindly." "Even if the boy does live, he'll be a cripple, worse than a cripple, a grotesque. Give me a good clean death." Tyrion replied with a shrug that accentuated the twist of his shoulders.
"Speaking for the grotesques," he said, "I beg to differ. Death is so terribly final, while life is full of possibilities."
Jamie smiled.
"You are a perverse little imp, aren't you?" "Oh, yes," Tyrion admitted. "I hope the boy does wake. I would be most interested to hear what he might have to say."
His brother's smile curdled like sour milk. "Tyrion, my sweet brother," he said darkly, "there are times when you give me cause to wonder whose side you are on." Tyrion's mouth was full of bread and fish. He took a swallow of strong black beer to wash it all down and grinned up wolfishly at Jaime.
"Why, Jaime, my sweet brother," he said, "you wound me. You know how much I love my family."
Davos. When he came up on deck, the long point of Driftmark was dwindling behind them, while Dragonstone rose from the sea ahead. A pale grey wisp of smoke blew from the top of the mountain to mark where the island lay.
"Dragonmont is restless this morning," Davos thought, "or else Melisandre is burning someone else."
Melisandre had been much in his thoughts as Shayala's dance made her way across Blackwater Bay and through the gullet, tacking against perverse contrary winds. The great fire that burned atop the sharp point watchtower at the end of Massey's Hook reminded him of the ruby she wore at her throat, and when the world turned red at dawn and sunset, the drifting clouds turned the same colour as the silks and satins of her rustling gowns. She would be waiting on Dragonstone as well, waiting in all her beauty and all her power, with her god and her shadows and his king. The Red Priestess had always seemed loyal to Stannis, until now.
"She has broken him, as a man breaks a horse. She would ride him to power if she could, and for that she gave my sons to the fire. I will cut the living heart from her breast and see how it burns."
He touched the hilt of the fine long Lycene dirk that the captain had given him. The captain had been very kind to him. His name was Corain Sathmantes, a Lycene like Salador San, whose ship this was. He had the same pale blue eyes you often saw on Lyce, set in a bony, weather-worn face, but he had spent many years trading in the Seven Kingdoms. When he learned that the man he had plucked from the sea was the celebrated Onion Knight, he gave him the use of his own cabin and his own clothes, and a pair of new boots that almost fit. He insisted that Davos share his provisions as well, though that turned out badly. His stomach could not tolerate the snails and lampreys and other rich food Captain Corain so relished, and after his first meal at the captain's table, he spent the rest of the day with one end or the other dangling over the rail. Dragonstone loomed larger with every stroke of the oars. Davos could see the shape of the mountain now, and on its side the great black citadel with its gargoyles and dragon towers. The bronze figurehead at the bow of Shayala's dance set up wings of salt spray as it cut the waves. He leaned his weight against the rail, grateful for its support. His ordeal had weakened him. If he stood too long, his leg shook, and sometimes he fell prey to uncontrollable fits of coughing and brought up gobs of bloody phlegm.
"There's nothing," he told himself. "Surely the gods did not bring me safe through fire and sea, only to kill me with a flux."
As he listened to the pounding of the oarmaster's drum, the thrum of the sail, and the rhythmic swish and creak of the oars, he thought back to his younger days, when these same sounds woke dread in his heart on many a misty morn. They heralded the approach of old Sir Tristraman's Sea Watch, and the Sea Watch was death to smugglers when Aerys Targaryen sat the Iron Throne.
"But that was another lifetime," he thought. "That was before the Onion Ship, before Storm's End, before Stannis shortened my fingers. That was before the war, or the Red Comet, Before I was a Seaworth, or a knight, I was a different man in those days, before Lord Stannis raised me high.
Captain Corain had told him of the end of Stannis's hopes. On the night, the river burned. The Lannisters had taken him from the flank, and his fickle bannermen had abandoned him by the hundreds in the hour of his greatest need.
King Renly's shade was seen as well, the captain said, slaying right and left as he led the Lion Lord's van. It said his green armour took a ghostly glow from the wildfire, and his antlers ran with golden flames. Renly's shade.
Davos wondered if his sons would return as shades as well. He had seen too many queer things on the sea to say that ghosts did not exist.
"Did none keep faith?"
he asked.
"Some few," the captain said. "The queen's kin, them in chief. We took off many who wore the fox and flowers, though many more were left ashore with all manner of badges. Lord Florent is the king's hand on Dragonstone now."
The mountain grew taller, crowned all in pale smoke. The sail sang, the drum beat, the oars pulled smoothly, and before very long the mouth of the harbour opened before them.
"So empty," Davos thought,
remembering how it had been before, with the ships crowding every quay and rocking at anchor off the breakwater. He could see Salador San's flagship Valerian moored at the quay, where Fury and her sisters had once tied up. The ships on either side of her had striped Lycene hulls as well. In vain he looked for any sign of Lady Maria or Wraith. They pulled down the sail as they entered the harbour, to dock on oars alone. The captain came to Davos as they were tying up. "My prince will wish to see you at once." A fit of coughing seized Davos as he tried to answer. He clutched the rail for support and spat over the side.
"The king," he wheezed. "I must go to the king. For where the king is, I will find Melisande."
"No one goes to the king," Corain Sathmentes replied firmly.
"A Salador San will tell you. Him first."
Davos was too weak to defy him. He could only nod. Salador San was not aboard his Valerian. They found him at another quay, a quarter mile distant, down in the hold of a big-bellied Pentoshi cog named Bountiful Harvest, counting cargo with two eunuchs. One held a lantern, the other a wax tablet and stylus.
37, 38, 39,
the old rogue was saying when Davos and the captain came down the hatch. Today he wore a wine-coloured tunic and high boots of bleached white leather inlaid with silver scrollwork. Pulling the stopper from a jar, he sniffed, sneezed, and said,
A coarse kind, and of the second quality, my nose declares. The bill of lading is saying 43 jars, eh? Where have the others gotten to, I'm wondering? These Pentoshi, do they think I am not counting, eh?
When he saw Davos, he stopped suddenly.
Is it pepper stinging my eyes, or tears? Is that the Knight of the Onions who stands before me? No, how can it be? My dear friend Davos died on the burning river, all agree. Why has he come to haunt me? I'm no ghost, Salla. What else? My onion knight was never so thin or so pale as you.
Salador San threaded his way between the jars of spice and bolts of cloth that filled the hole of the merchant, wrapped Davos in a fierce embrace, then kissed him once on each cheek and a third time on his forehead.
You are still warm, sir, and I feel your heart thumpity-thumping. Can it be true? The sea that swallowed you has spit you up again?
Davos was reminded of Patchface, Princess Shireen's lackwit fool. He had gone into the sea as well, and when he came out, he was mad.
Am I mad as well?
He coughed into a gloved hand and said,
I swam beneath a chain and washed ashore on a spear of the Merlin King. I would have died there if Shehala's dance had not come upon me.
Salador San threw an arm around the captain's shoulder.
This was well done, Corain. You will be having a fine reward, I am thinking. Maizomar, be a good eunuch, eh, and take my friend Davos to the honor's cabin. Fetch him some hot wine with cloves. I am misliking the sound of that cough. Squeeze some lime in it as well, and bring white cheese and a bowl of those cracked green olives we counted earlier. Davos, I will join you soon, once I have bespoken our good captain. You will be forgiving me, eh, I know. You do not eat all the olives, or I must be cross with you.
Davos let the elder of the two eunuchs escort him to a large and lavishly furnished cabin at the stern of the ship. The carpets were deep, the windows stained glass, and any of the great leather chairs would have seated three of Davos quite comfortably. The cheese and olives arrived shortly, and a cup of steaming hot red wine. He held it between his hands and sipped it gratefully. The warmth felt soothing as it spread through his chest. Salador San appeared not long after.
You must be forgiving me for the wine, my friend. These Pentashi would drink their own water if it were purple. It will help my chest, said Davos. Hot wine is better than a compress, my mother used to say. You shall be needing compresses as well, I am thinking. Sitting on a spear all this long time, eh? Oh, my! How are you finding that excellent chair? He has fat cheeks, eh? Does he not?
Who? Asked Davos between sips of hot wine.
Illyrio Mopatis. A whale with whiskers. I am telling you truly, these chairs were built to his measure, though he is seldom bestirring himself from Pentas to sit in them. A fat man always sits comfortably, eh? I'm thinking. For he carries his pillow with him wherever he goes, eh? How is it you come by a Pentashi ship? Asked Davos. Have you gone pirate again, my lord?
He set his empty cup aside.
Vile calumny! Who has suffered more from pirates than Salador San? I ask only what is due to me. Much gold is owed, oh yes, but I am not without reason, eh? So, in place of coin, I have taken a handsome parchment, very crisp. It bears the name and seal of Lord Alistair Florent, the hand of the king. I am made Lord of Blackwater Bay, and no vessel may be crossing my lordly waters without my lordly leave. No? And when these outlaws are trying to steal past me in the night to avoid my lawful duties and customs, why, they are no better than smugglers, eh? So I am well within my rights to seize them. The old pirate laughed. I cut off no man's fingers, though. What good are bits of fingers? The ships I am taking, the cargoes, a few ransoms, nothing unreasonable.
He gave Davos a sharp look.
You are unwell, my friend, eh? That cough. And so thin. I am seeing your bones through your skin, and yet I am not seeing your little bag of finger bones.
Old habit made Davos reach for the leather pouch that was no longer there.
I lost her in the river. My luck. Oh, the river was terrible,
Salador San said solemnly.
Even from the bay I was seeing and shuddering.
Davos coughed, spat, and coughed again.
I saw Black Brother burning, and Fury as well.
He finally managed hoarsely.
Did none of our ships escape the fire?
Part of him still hoped.
Lord Stefan, Ragged Jenner, Swift Sword, Laughing Lord, and some others were upstream of the pyromancer's pissing, yes. They did not burn, but with the chain raised, neither could they be flying. Some few were surrendering, eh? Most rode far up the Blackwater, away from the battling, and then were sunk by their crews, so they would not be falling into Lannister hands, eh? Ragged Jenner and Laughing Lord are still playing pirate on the river, I have heard, but who can say if it is so, eh? Lady Maria?
Davos asked.
Wraith?
Salador San put a hand on Davos's forearm and gave a squeeze.
No, of them, no. I am sorry, my friend. They were good men, your Dale and Allard. But this comfort I can give you. Your young Devon was among those we took off at the end. The brave boy never once left the king's side, or so they say.
For a moment he felt almost dizzy. His relief was so palpable. He had been afraid to ask about Devon.
The mother is merciful. I must go to him, Salar. I must see him. Yes, said Salador San, and you will be wanting to sail to Cape Wrath, I know, to see your wife and your two little ones, eh? You must be having a new ship, I am thinking. His Grace will give me a ship, said Davos.
The Lycini shook his head.
Of ships His Grace has none, but Salador San has many, eh? The king's ships burned up on the river, but not mine. You shall have one, old friend. You will sail for me, yes. You will dance into Braavos and Myr and Valentis in the black of night, all unseen, and dance out again with silks and spices. We will be having fat purses, yes? You are kind, Salar, but my duty is to my king, not your purse. The war will go on. Stannis is still the rightful heir by all the laws of the Seven Kingdoms. All the laws are not helping when all the ships burn up, I am thinking. And your king, well, you will be finding him changed, I am fearing. Since the battle, he sees no one, but broods in his stone drum. Queen Selyse keeps court for him, with her uncle, the Lord Alistair, who is naming himself the Hand. The king's seal she has given to this uncle to fix to the letters he writes, even to my pretty parchment. But it is a little kingdom they are ruling, poor and rocky, yes? There is no gold, not even a little bit, to pay faithful Salador San what is owed him, and only those knights that we took off at the end, and no ships, but my little brave few, eh?
A sudden racking cough bent Davos over. Salador San moved to help him, but he waved him off, and after a moment he recovered.
No one? He wheezed. What do you mean? He sees no one.
His voice sounded wet and thick even in his own ears, and for a moment the cabin swam dizzily around him.
No one but her,
said Salador San, and Davos did not have to ask who he meant.
My friend, you tire yourself. It is a bed you are needing, not Salador San. A bed and many blankets with a hot compress for your chest and more wine and cloves.
Davos shook his head.
I will be fine. Tell me, Salar, I must know. No one but Melisandre?
The Lycene gave him a long, doubtful look and continued reluctantly.
The guards keep all others away, even his queen and his little daughter. Servants bring meals that no one eats.
He leaned forward and lowered his voice.
Queer talking I have heard of hungry fires within the mountain, and how Stannis and the Red Woman go down together to watch the flames, eh? There are shafts, they say, and secret stairs down into the mountain's heart. Into hot places where only she may walk unburned. It is enough and more to give an old man such terrors that sometimes he can scarcely find the strength to eat. Melisandre, Davos shivered. The Red Woman did this to him, he said. She sent the fire to consume us. to punish Tanis for setting her aside, to teach him that he could not hope to win without her sorceries.
The Lysenae chose a plump olive from the bowl between them.
You are not the first to be saying this, my friend, but if I am you, I am not saying it so loudly, eh? Dragonstone crawls with these queen's men. Oh, yes, and they have sharp ears and sharper knives.
He popped the olive into his mouth.
I have a knife myself. Captain Corain made me a gift of it.
He pulled out the dirk and laid it on the table between them.
A knife to cut out Melisande's heart, if she has one.
Salador San spit out an olive pit.
Devas, good Devas, you must not be saying such things, even in jest. No jest. I mean to kill her, if she can be killed by mortal weapons.
Devas was not certain that she could. He had seen old Maester Cresson slip poison into her wine. With his own eyes he had seen it. But when they both drank from the poison cup, it was a maester who died, not the Red Priestess.
A knife through the heart, though. Even demons can be killed by cold iron, the singers say. These are dangerous talkings, my friend.
Salador San warned him.
I am thinking you are still sick from the sea. The fever has cooked your wits, yes? Best you are taking to your bed for a long resting until you are stronger. Until my resolve weakens, you mean?
Davis got to his feet. He did feel feverish and a little dizzy, but it did not matter.
You are a treacherous old rogue, Salador San, but a good friend all the same.
Lysenae stroked his pointed silver beard.
So, with this great friend you will be staying, yes? No, I will be going.
He coughed.
Go, look at you. You cough, you tremble, you are thin and weak. Where will you be going? To the castle. My bed is there, and my son.
And the Red Woman?
Salador-san said suspiciously.
She is in the castle also. Her too.
Davis slid the dirk back into its sheath.
You are an onion smuggler. What do you know of skulkings and stabbings? And you are ill. You cannot even hold the dirk. Do you know what will happen to you if you are caught? While we were burning on the river, the queen was burning traitors. Servants of the dark, she named them, poor men. And the Red Woman sang as the fires were lit.
Davis was unsurprised.
I knew, he thought, I knew, before he told me.
She took Lord Sunglass from the dungeons, he guessed, and Hubbard Rampton's sons.
Just so, and burn them, as she will burn you. If you kill the Red Woman, they will burn you for revenge. And if you fail to kill her, they will burn you for the trying. She will sing, and you will scream, and then you will die. And you have only just come back to life.
And this is why, said Davis, to do this thing, to make an end of Melisande of Achaye and all her works. Why else would the sea have spit me out? You know Blackwater Bay as well as I do, Seller. No sensible captain would ever take his ship through the spears of the Merlin King and risk ripping out his bottom. Shayala's dance should never have come near me.
A wind, eh?
Insisted Salador San loudly.
An ill wind is all. A wind drove her too far to the south.
And who set the wind? Salar, the mother spoke to me.
The old Lysenae blinked at him.
Your mother is dead.
Thee, mother! She blessed me with 7 sons, and yet I let them burn her. She spoke to me. We call the fire, she said. We call the shadows, too. I rode Melisande into the bowels of Storm's End and watched her birth a horror.
He saw it still in his nightmares, the gaunt black hands pushing against her thighs as it wriggled free of her swollen womb.
She killed Cresson and Lord Renly, and a brave man named Courtney Penrose, and she killed my sons as well. Now it is time someone killed her."
"Someone?" said Salador-san. "Yes, just so, someone, but not you. You are weak as a child and no warrior. Stay, I beg you. We will talk more and you will eat, and perhaps we will sail to Bravos and hire a faceless man to do this thing, yes? But you, no. You must sit and eat." "He is making this much harder," thought Davis wearily, "and it was perishingly hard to begin with. I have a vengeance in my belly, Salla. It leaves no room for food. Let me go now. For our friendship, wish me luck, and let me go."
Salador-san pushed himself to his feet.
"You are no true friend, I am thinking. When you are dead, who will be bringing your ashes and bones back to your lady wife, eh? And telling her that she has lost a husband and four sons? Only sad old Salador-san. But so be it, brave Sir Knight. Go rushing to your grave. I will gather your bones in a sack and bring them to the sons you leave behind to wear in little bags around their necks, eh?"
He waved an angry hand with rings on every finger.
"Go! Go, 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 go!"
Davis did not want to leave like this.
"Salar, go, or stay better, but if you are going, go."
He went. His walk up from the bountiful harvest to the gates of Dragonstone was long and lonely. The dockside streets where soldiers and sailors and small folk had thronged were empty and deserted. Where once he had stepped around squealing pigs and naked children, rats scurried. His legs felt like pudding beneath him, and thrice the coughing racked him so badly that he had to stop and rest. No one came to help him, nor even peered through a window to see what was the matter. The windows were shuttered, the doors barred, and more than half the houses displayed some mark of mourning.
"Thousands sailed up the Blackwater Rush, and hundreds came back," Davis reflected. "My sons did not die alone. May the mother have mercy on them all."
When he reached the castle gates, he found them shut as well. Davis pounded on the iron-studded wood with his fist. When there was no answer, he kicked at it again and again. Finally, a crossbowman appeared atop the barbican, peering down between two towering gargoyles.
"Who goes there?"
He craned his head back and cupped his hands around his mouth.
"Sir Davis Seaworth, to see his grace." "Are you drunk? Go away and stop that pounding."
Salador-san had warned him. Davis tried a different tack.
"Send for my son, then. Devon, the king's squire."
The guard frowned.
"Who did you say you were?"
"Davis,"
he shouted.
"The Onion Knight."
The head vanished to return a moment later.
"Be off with you. The Onion Knight died on the river. His ship burned."
"His ship burned," Davis agreed. "But he lived, and here he stands. Is Jate still captain of the gate?"
"Who?"
"Jate Blackberry. He knows me well enough."
"I never heard of him. Most like he's dead."
"Lord Chittering, then."
"Oh, that one, I know. He burned on the Blackwater."
"Hookface Will, Hal the Hug?"
"Dead and dead,"
the crossbowman said, but his face betrayed a sudden doubt.
"You wait there."
He vanished again. Davis waited.
"Gone, all gone," he thought dully, remembering how Fat Hal's white belly always showed beneath his grease-stained doublet, the long scar the fishhook had left across Will's face, the way Jate always doffed his cap at the women, be they 5 or 50, high-born or low.
"Drowned or burned, with my sons and 1,000 others, gone to make a king in hell."
Suddenly the crossbowman was back,
Go round to the Sally Port, and they'll admit you."
Davis did as he was bid. The guards who ushered him inside were strangers to him. They carried spears, and on their breasts they wore the fox and flowers sigil of House Florent. They escorted him not to the stone drum, as he'd expected, but under the arch of the Dragon's Tail and down to Aegon's garden.
"Wait here," the sergeant told him. "Does his grace know that I've returned?" asked Davis. "Bugger all if I know. Wait," I said.
The man left, taking his spearman with him. Aegon's garden had a pleasant piney smell to it, and tall dark trees rose on every side. There were wild roses as well, and towering thorny hedges, and a boggy spot where cranberries grew.
"Why have they brought me here?" Davis wondered.
Then he heard a faint ringing of bells, and a child's giggle, and suddenly the fool, Patchface, popped from the bushes, shambling along as fast as he could go, with Princess Shireen hot on his heels.
"You come back now," she was shouting after him. "Patches, you come back!"
When the fool saw Davis, he jerked to a sudden halt, the bells on his antlered tin helmet going ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling. Hopping from one foot to the other, he sang,
"Fool's blood, king's blood, blood on the maiden's thigh, but chains for the guests and chains for the bridegroom, I.
Shireen almost caught him then, but at the last instant he hopped over a patch of bracken and vanished among the trees. The princess was right behind him. The sight of them made Davis smile. He had turned a cuff into his gloved hand when another small shape crashed out of the hedge and bowled right into him, knocking him off his feet. The boy went down as well, but he was up again almost at once.
"What are you doing here?"
he demanded as he brushed himself off. Jet-black hair fell to his collar, and his eyes were a startling blue. "You shouldn't get in my way when I'm running."
"No," Davis agreed, "I shouldn't."
Another fit of coughing seized him as he struggled to his feet.
"Are you unwell?"
The boy took him by the arm and pulled him to his feet.
"Should I summon the maester?"
Davis shook his head.
"A cough. It will pass."
The boy took him in his word.
"We were playing monsters and maidens," he explained. "I was the monster. It's a childish game, but my cousin likes it. Do you have a name?"
"Sir Davis Seaworth."
The boy looked him up and down dubiously.
"Are you certain? You don't look very knightly."
"I am the Knight of the Onions, my lord."
The blue eyes blinked.
"The one with the black ship."
"You know the tale?"
"You brought my uncle Stannis fish to eat before I was born, when Lord Tyrell had him under siege."
The boy drew himself up tall.
"I am Edric Storm," he announced, "King Robert's son."
"Of course you are."
Davis had known that almost at once. The lad had the prominent ears of a Florent, but the hair, the eyes, the jaw, the cheekbones, those were all Baratheon.
"Did you know my father?"
Edric Storm demanded.
"I saw him many a time, while calling on your uncle at court, but we never spoke."
"My father taught me to fight," the boy said proudly. "He came to see me almost every year, and sometimes we trained together. On my last name day, he sent me a warhammer just like his, only smaller. They made me leave it at Storm's End, though. Is it true my Uncle Stannis cut off your fingers?"
"Only the last joint. I still have fingers, only shorter."
"Show me."
Davis peeled his glove off. The boy studied his hand carefully.
"He did not shorten your thumb?"
"No," Davis coughed. "No, he left me that."
"He should not have chopped any of your fingers," the lad decided. "That was ill done."
"I was a smuggler."
"Yes, but you smuggled him fish and onions."
"Lord Stannis knighted me for the onions and took my fingers for the smuggling."
He pulled his glove back on.
"My father would not have chopped your fingers."
"As you say, my lord." "Robert was a different man than Stannis, true enough. The boy is like him, aye, and like Renly as well."
That thought made him anxious. The boy was about to say something more when they heard steps. Davis turned. Sir Axel Florent was coming down the garden path with a dozen guards in quilted jerkins. On their breasts they wore the fiery heart of the Lord of Light.
Queen's men,
Davis thought. A cough came on him suddenly. Sir Axel was short and muscular, with a barrel chest, thick arms, bandy legs, and hair growing from his ears. The Queen's uncle, he had served as Castellan of Dragonstone for a decade, and had always treated Davis courteously, knowing he enjoyed the favour of Lord Stannis. But there was neither courtesy nor warmth in his tone as he said,
"Sir Davis, an undrowned. How can that be?"
"Onions float, sir. Have you come to take me to the king?"
"I've come to take you to the dungeon."
Sir Axel waved his men forward.
"Seize him and take his dirk. He means to use it on our lady."
John. They brought forth the king beyond the wall, with his hands bound by hempen rope and a noose around his neck. The other end of the rope was looped about the saddle horn of Sir Godfrey Fairing's courser. The giant slayer and his mount were armoured in silver steel inlaid with niello. Mance Rayder wore only a thin tunic that left his limbs naked to the cold. They could have let him keep his cloak, Jon Snow thought, the one the wildling woman patched, with strips of crimson silk. Small wonder that the wall was weeping. Mance knows the haunted forest better than any ranger, Jon had told King Stannis, in his final effort to convince his grace that the king beyond the wall would be of more use to them alive than dead. He knows Tormund Giantsbane. He has fought the others, and he had the horn of Joramun and did not blow it. He did not bring down the wall when he could have. His words fell on deaf ears. Stannis had remained unmoved. The law was plain. A deserter's life was forfeit. Beneath the weeping wall, Nailin Melisandre raised her pale white hands. "We all must choose," she proclaimed. "Man or woman, young or old, lord or peasant, our choices are the same." Her voice made Jon Snow think of anise and nutmeg and cloves. She stood at the king's side on a wooden scaffold raised above the pit.
"We choose light or we choose darkness. We choose good or we choose evil. We choose the true God or the false."
Mance Rayder's thick grey-brown hair blew about his face as he walked. He pushed it from his eyes with bound hands, smiling. But when he saw the cage, his courage failed him. The Queen's men had made it from the trees of the haunted forest, from saplings and supple branches, pine boughs sticky with sap, and the bone-white fingers of the weirwoods. They bent them and twisted them around and through each other to weave a wooden lattice, then hung it high above a deep pit filled with logs, leaves, and kindling. The wildling king recoiled from the sight.
"No," he cried. "Mercy, this is not right. I am not the king there."
Sir Godfrey gave a pull on the rope. The king beyond the wall had no choice but to stumble after him, the rope choking off his words. When he lost his feet, Godfrey dragged him the rest of the way. Mance was bloody when the queen's men half shoved, half carried him to the cage. A dozen men at arms heaved together to hoist him into the air. Lady Melisandre watched him rise.
"Free folk, here stands your king of lies, and here is the horn he promised would bring down the wall."
Two queen's men brought forth the horn of Joramun, black and banded with old gold, 8 feet long from end to end. Runes were carved into the golden bands, the writing of the first men. Joramun had died thousands of years ago, but Mance had found his grave beneath a glacier, high up in the frost fangs. And Joramun blew the horn of winter and woke giants from the earth. Egret had told John that Mance never found the horn. She lied, or else Mance kept it secret even from his own. 1,000 captives watched through the wooden bars of their stockade as the horn was lifted high. All were ragged and half-starved. Wildlings, the Seven Kingdoms called them. They named themselves the Free Folk. They looked neither wild nor free, only hungry, frightened, numb.
"The Horn of Jaruman," Melisandre said. "No, call it the Horn of Darkness. If the wall falls, night falls as well. The long night that never ends, it must not happen, will not happen. The Lord of Light has seen his children in their peril and sent a champion to them, Azor Ahai, reborn." She swept a hand toward Stannis, and the great ruby at her throat pulsed with light. "He is stone, and she is flame." The king's eyes were blue bruises sunk deep in a hollow face. He wore grey plate, a fur-trimmed cloak of cloth of gold flowing from his broad shoulders. His breastplate had a flaming heart inlaid above his own. Girding his brows was a red-gold crown with points like twisting flames. Val stood beside him, tall and fair. They had crowned her with a simple circlet of dark bronze, yet she looked more regal in bronze than Stannis did in gold. Her eyes were grey and fearless, unflinching. Beneath an ermine cloak she wore white and gold. Her honey blonde hair had been done up in a thick braid that hung over her right shoulder to her waist. The chill in the air had put colour in her cheeks. Lady Melisandre wore no crown, but every man there knew that she was Stannis Baratheon's real queen, not the homely woman he had left to shiver at Eastwatch by the sea. Talk was the king did not mean to send for Queen Selyse and their daughter until the night fort was ready for habitation. John felt sorry for them. The wall offered few of the comforts that Southron ladies and little highborn girls were used to, and the night fort offered none. That was a grim place, even at the best of times. "Free folk," cried Melisandre, "behold the fate of those who choose the darkness."
The horn of Joraman burst into flame. It went up with a whoosh as swirling tongues of green and yellow fire leapt up, crackling all along its length. John's Garen shied nervously, and up and down the ranks others fought to still their mounts as well. A moan came from the stockade as the free folk saw their hope afire. A few began to shout and curse, but most lapsed into silence. For half a heartbeat, the runes graven on the gold band seemed to shimmer in the air. The queen's men gave a heave and sent the horn tumbling down into the fire pit. Inside his cage, Mance Rayder clawed at the noose about his neck with bound hands and screamed incoherently of treachery and witchery, denying his kingship, denying his people, denying his name, denying all that he had ever been. He shrieked for mercy and cursed the Red Woman and began to laugh hysterically. John watched unblinking. He dare not appear squeamish before his brothers. He had ordered out 200 men, more than half the garrison of Castle Black, mounted in solemn sable ranks, with tall spears in hand. They had drawn up their hoods to shadow their faces and hide the fact that so many were greybeards and green boys. The free folk feared the watch. John wanted them to take that fear with them to their new home south of the wall. The horn crashed amongst the logs and leaves and kindling. Within 3 heartbeats, the whole pit was aflame. Clutching the bars of his cage with bound hands, Mance sobbed and begged. When the fire reached him, he did a little dance. His screams became one long, wordless shriek of fear and pain. Within his cage, he fluttered like a burning leaf, a moth caught in a candle flame. John found himself remembering a song. "Brothers, oh brothers, my days here are done. The Dornishman's taken my life. But what does it matter? For all men must die, and I've tasted the Dornish man's wife. Val stood on the platform as still as if she'd been carved of salt. She will not weep, nor look away. John wondered